Alrighty guys, we might get started. Welcome to the last session of the day. Thank you very much for turning up. The people that are here, and of course, you can always get these slides online in the recording later on. So hello to anyone listening on the recordings in the future. My name is Alistair Spears. I'm a program manager in the Office 365 and Exchange team. So we look at all of those products. Essentially, we think of it as the productivity infrastructure portion of the Office division, and then obviously SharePoint, Project, Visio, and Link as well. But today we're here to talk about Office 365 security, privacy, and trust. There are interrelated topics, so it makes sense to kind of group them together. And you know, it's an interesting topic. I was talking to Bharath earlier, and this is really the area that we get the most questions on Office 365. People are fairly familiar with Exchange, fairly familiar with SharePoint and Link and Office, but this notion of cloud computing and what it means for my security posture, my privacy obligations, my regulatory compliance is a big issue, and so we wanted to take you through that today. For those that don't know, level setting, and this is the first tech ed North America, we've been talking about Office 365 since it's been released, so just a kind of a brief overview of what Office 365 is. It's our cloud service versions of Office, Exchange, SharePoint, and Link. You know, you've been trusting us to build this software and deploy, and you've been using it for some time, and now with Office 365, we're asking you to trust us to run it as well. And you know, the thing I love about Office 365, and for our business, even internally, as we develop these products, you know, when it was a hosted, when it was a product that we gave to you to deploy and run yourself, we didn't feel the pain of deployments and of migrations and of patching. And right now, with Office 365, it's an online service. We have a financially backed SLA of 99.9% uptime, which equates to about 43 minutes a month. Of downtime that we're allowed before we start paying our customers back. And so, you know, in the product teams, you know, we'll be waking up the developers at 2 a.m. to fix these issues, whereas in the past, maybe you waited a week or 3 weeks for a hot fix and those sorts of things. But with a 43-minute SLA, we've got to be much faster at patching these things. And we learn through this process, and it really benefits our on-premises software as well, because you know, despite the name Exchange Online, it is still Exchange. There's no difference in the product that's running in the services. It's just run at a much bigger scale and a much perhaps different topology than you'd run yourself in your own data center. So what's in Office 365? Four key things, you know, the greatest hits from the Office division. Microsoft Office is included in Office 365. This is both the web apps and also the client office software. A lot of people think that is this some sort of remote desktop situation or anything like that. No, it's not. You'll still download Office, you'll run it on your PC, installs just like normal software. The licensing is a little bit different. It's a per-user license in Office 365, a month-to-month per-user license, rather than a perpetual device license that you may be used to in Office in typical on-premises. So that means a couple of things. Firstly, it means you can run Office on up to 5 devices. We're actually licensing it per user, not per device, so you don't need to buy Office for each PC, just each user. And so the activation works a little bit differently as well. It doesn't use KMS or Mac activation. It actually uses the Office 365 service and pings the service to make sure that that account is provisioned in your Office 365 tenant. But for all intents and purposes, it's Office's Office's Office. Link Online, our IM presence and conferencing solution. Exchange Online, 25 gig mailboxes. That's pretty big. So that's great there. And SharePoint Online for my sites, collaboration, and those sorts of things as well. For the end users, you know, you really don't notice any difference with these products. It's still Exchange, it's still SharePoint, it's still Link. For IT admins, it is slightly different because you are managing a remote solution and it's a multi-tenanted environment, so you don't get access to the servers themselves. We don't want you logging into the servers themselves and messing with any of that stuff. We want to manage that for you, patch that for you, upgrade that for you, and give you a little bit more control over how you work it. So that's Office 365, and you've been trusting us for a long time to build this software and deploy this software. And I guess with Office 365, we're asking you to trust us to run it as well. So that's probably a good segue for Bharath to talk about some of the trust policies we have in Office 365.
Hey, thanks Alistair. Hello all, my name is Bharath, and I'm a technical product manager. My focus areas are trust, privacy, security, compliance, and I'm also responsible for the government aspects of Office 365. And I also run a web page called the Trust Center. If you haven't checked it out already, please do go and visit that web page. So we do get a lot of concerns and questions every time a customer thinks about moving to the cloud. One of the primary questions that we do get is questions around privacy. Customers feel often a loss of control on knowing what's really happening to their data. They also have regulatory concerns. They need to meet a lot of regulatory obligations, and they aren't sure if by uploading all their data to Microsoft data centers, would they still be meeting those regulatory standards or not. The last concern is where does the data sit, and what about the physical and logical security of the data? Is it encrypted? How is it transmitted across the network? And that sort of a thing. So can I trust the cloud is pretty much the chief concern among a lot of customers who are considering moving to Office 365. To drill down, some of the specific questions that we get fall into four broad areas. The first area being privacy, and people first want to know, what does privacy at Microsoft mean? What does it specifically mean with Office 365? I can't tell you the number of times we get questions around, hey, are you mining my data to build advertising products? Are you using my data to build a product of your own? So this is by far the most popular question that we get. From a transparency perspective, they want to know where their data resides. Is it being shipped out of the country? Is it being held in the same country? And they want to know about this information. Specifically, they also want to know who within Microsoft has access to customer data. Who can access their data? What kind of data can a Microsoft employee access? And so we have answers to those sort of questions in this 1 hour as well. The third category of questions center around compliance. What certifications and capabilities does Microsoft Office 365 have? How do we support a customer's compliance requirements? And this is, again, a very popular question. A customer often asks us, do I have the right to audit Microsoft? Can I come and visit your data centers, see if you follow the control sets that you claim to be following? The last question is cloud computing secure? This is a very broad question, but they specifically ask, is Office 365 secure? Is a specific cloud product within Microsoft secure? And the hope is that at the end of the session, you will have answers to most of these questions. So before we get deep into this session, I do encourage you to visit the Trust Center. It's not, you know, a full-blown legal contract kind of a web page. It's written in very simple English. It's meant for both enterprise customers and for small, medium business customers. We don't talk a lot of legal language in this. It's in plain English. It links to a lot of videos that describe our security and privacy processes, and it also links to white papers that we have written that describes in detail our security and privacy policies. So the way we think about our trust and Office 365 is we break it down into four pillars. And this is how you will find this information in the Trust Center. Privacy is our first pillar, and we strongly believe that an IT service provider needs to respect the privacy of the customer's data. They should be transparent about what they do with the customer data, who has access to customer data, and where that data is located. The third thing is it's a good thing for you to hear us talking about how great we are about privacy and security, but you're also interested in knowing what do third-party independent auditors think about our privacy and security standards. And we need to disclose that information to you as well. The last aspect is security, both in terms of physical security, logical security, security across different layers of the network, and we will go into that in detail as well. So let's start with our privacy pillar. What do we mean by privacy? Privacy can mean a whole spectrum of things. It's essentially our data stewardship policies. Once you trust your data with us, how do we handle that data? For what purpose do we use that data? So all questions around this can fall into either the security bucket or the privacy bucket. So for example, if you sort of trust your data with a cloud service provider and someone unconnected, a third party comes and does malicious things to your data, that's a security concern. If the IT service provider mishandles your data or violates the privacy of your data, that's a privacy concern. So privacy is how an IT service provider who's offering you the cloud service treats your data, versus security is how does that IT service provider protect your data from other third parties with malicious intent. So there is a lot of common area between security and privacy, and that common area is around information disclosure. And we'll talk about both sets of practices in this session. So some of the key things that we would like to talk about from a privacy standpoint is we don't build advertising products out of your core customer data. So we don't scan into your email, the body of your email. We don't look into the documents that you store in SharePoint to create indexes and keywords that lead to advertising products. We are fundamentally a business productivity organization. That's what this product is all about. We are not a subset of a search business. So essentially, our primary objective is to provide you the service that you have paid us for, and we want to stay true to that objective.
That's right. It's a pretty honest business model. You know, you pay us, we run a service for you. We don't try and recoup the cost any other way or any other service. So you pay for what it's worth. We don't try and make any money. You're not a product. You know, Office 365 is the service we're offering, and you're a customer, not an audience or a market for any other service.
Thanks. The second important thing is we want to keep this as unambiguous as possible. Any data that you offer that's generated by the customer and is uploaded into the Office 365 service, the customer owns that data. At no situation would Office 365 or Microsoft claim ownership to that data. You can remove that data from the service and walk away at any time of your choosing. And that's essentially the data portability provision that we offer you. Also, if you notice, Office 365 is a business service. It doesn't rhyme with or sound similar to Hotmail. So Hotmail is our separate consumer service. Office 365 is our business service. We don't co-locate them or co-mingle the data that customers put as part of their commercial business with other consumer online services.
Right.
So we don't mingle data that are there for the business purpose with consumer data.
That's right. You can almost think of Office 365 as a data center within the data center. And if you've seen a diorama downstairs in the expo hall, it's really a very separate data center inside of a larger Microsoft data center with separate access controls, separate policies, separate staff that manage it inside of this environment. So it is very different from our consumer service.
So this is kind of a busy slide, but this is publicly available information. If you go to the Trust Center, you'll be able to see this information. Let me help you navigate this slide. This tells you the different ways in which we classify customer data and who has access to that data and for what purpose do we access to that data. So the part that you're most interested is in the first table on the rightmost column. That's called as the core customer data. That's the customer authored data. Those would be the text within your email, the attachments of your email, the contents of your SharePoint document. So we primarily access the data to give to provide you the service or for any operational or troubleshooting purpose. We also access the data for malware prevention. But outside of this, there is no access into that data. And operations people are granted access into that data set on an exception basis, and that exception is sort of, it has a timer to it. So it's a one-time exception with a timer, and they only get access because they need to troubleshoot something within the service.
Yeah.
So everything else is essentially usage data or headers of emails and all those things, but the core customer data is very sacred and has, you know, is very tightly walled.
Yeah.
And just to be clear here, that address book data, that is not your user's address books or anything like that. That we're just referring to the administrator account, so we can notify that information.
Yeah.
It's not end user address book information. It's just details of who you are in the service, in case we need to notify you and to help troubleshoot things or for other reasons as well.
So transparency. This essentially lets you know where your data resides, who can access it, and what we do with it. Who can access it and what we do with it? You just had a preview of that in the privacy section. So what we also disclose to you is where your data is stored. And we have a page called as the Geographic Boundaries page in the Trust Center, where there's a clear map of different data centers. And we also disclose to you as to what the logic is that we use to determine where to store your data. So when you sign the contract with Microsoft, you will be asked to provide a ship-to address. That's essentially the physical address where the customer is located. That address determines the storage location of your data. So if your ship-to address is within North America, your data will be stored in North America. If your ship-to address is within the European Union region, your data will be essentially stored within the European Union region. So that's the logic we use, and we are very transparent about disclosing this in the Trust Center. So,
yeah, this is it's an important thing because this keeps your data in the same legal environment as your main office as well, so you're subject to similar laws and those sorts of things. Importantly, we don't stripe the data across all of the services. We have geographic redundancy within the region, but we don't, for instance, if you're a customer in North America, your data does not live in an Asia data center or a Europe data center. It lives within the region that you specify.
And the Trust Center also has a policy where if there are changes to data maps or any regions of the Trust Center that impacts where your data is located or who is accessing the data, you can actually sign up to be notified of those changes. And this option is there for every administrator who has access to an admin account of Office 365. Yes?
How many data centers in the U.S.?
So there are anywhere between 10 and 100 data centers located all around the world.
Yeah. So we don't disclose the exact number of data centers that we have or the ones that we operate Office 365 out of, but as a rough example, for our essentially anchor data centers, and these are the massive ones that do the majority of the work, is between 10 and 100 around the world. In the United States, we have some on the East Coast, some on the West Coast. We like to spread them out. And we have a number of different data centers around the place. So we don't disclose the exact locations. They're anonymous-looking buildings that could be shipping anything. You'd probably only notice by the amount of power that they suck in that that's a data center. Yeah. So we have backups within the data centers, and we have a geo-redundant backup as well, a complete data center pair. So in the case of Office 365, we always pair the data centers, and so there's a primary data center and a secondary data center. Some users are on one, some users are on the other. So in the case of a massive failure. We can fail over to another data center. If you can imagine an earthquake or a natural disaster, we have another data center in a same legal environment, but different location, so that you can so we can make sure we have continuity of operations across that environment as well. We also publish RPOs and RTO times for this information. We have a service description for service reliability, and we have a session tomorrow morning at 8:30 to talk a little bit more about our service reliability framework and our policies around that as well. There is. You know, we generally deploy, in the case of North America, different sides of the country. So
far what we focused on was how does Microsoft handle customer data? How transparent is Microsoft on how they handle customer data? The other aspect is our approach to security. What Alistair will take you through is our different security policies and practices that we follow to keep your data secure.
Thanks, Bharath. Security is a big topic, and so I'll try and take you through a lot of the security aspects, not only the individual workloads in Office 365, such as Office, Exchange, and SharePoint, but also our framework across Microsoft to how we go about designing secure software. Has anyone heard of the MSDL before? Show of hands. This is the Microsoft Security Development Lifecycle. For Microsoft to ship a product, we must go through this process. All of our engineers are educated in this process. A lot of training goes on. And you know, when you have software that runs on for a billion users, we take this stuff very, very seriously. We have Follow the Sun incident response centers that are constantly 24/7 monitoring reactive threats and proactive analysis of all of our products and services. And Office 365, Exchange, SharePoint, and Link are no different to this model. So we also work with a lot of our partners, third-party vendors, to make sure that they're aware of this process, and we evangelize, if you like, this process. We want anyone building on top of a Microsoft platform to be, we'd love them to use the same model for security reasons, because, you know, you're as strong as your weakest link, and when you have ISV solutions or third-party products, we absolutely want to make sure that they're following a secure model as well. Essentially, how this works: a lot of education, and we treat security as a feature of the product. So even before code is starting to, we're starting to write code, we're actually doing our security feature reviews. We're writing security specs. There is a security review of every feature specification that we write before we even ship. So it's on paper, security is done right from the envisioning phase when we design software and services. It's not something that we tack on the end as a beta test or as a testing responsibility as well. It's core to everything that we do. So in the implementation, obviously we have a lot of approved tools, a lot of guidance at writing secure code. We do a lot of static analysis and a lot of verification of this process as well. And then, of course, incident response, release criteria, FSR, security review. Essentially, the security team has to sign off on this software before we'll even release it. And this is why you may see every now and then Microsoft acquire a company or a piece of software and nothing happens with it for 3 years, and then it ships with a different name and a vastly different look. This is because often, and this is the case of Groove. When we acquired Groove, which is now known as SharePoint Workspace, you know, we took that tool and then redesigned it from the ground up using a security development lifecycle to make sure that it was as secure as possible and it would fit within our security approach. So if we just look at Office security now as a starting point, we've been at this for quite some time. In Office XP, we introduced features like macro security levels. In Office 2003, we released things like crypto API support, trusted publishers, ActiveX control security. 2007, again, a dramatic redesign of a lot of the security capabilities in Office 2007. and 2010, adding a lot more security features as well. And you can see over time, the unique security issue is being reported on the clients. And so when we adopted this model to approaching security, using the security development lifecycle had real noticeable changes in the way that that security was handled and the amount of security issues we had with the product. So it's a tried and tested model. We've been using it for a long time. We've been improving it. But there are always new threats. There are always emergent threats. And so we can't rest on our laurels with this. And as we look to the cloud in the future, we need to make sure that we have that same rigor around shipping services as well as we have around shipping products. You know, one of the big risks that came out, you know, and if you look back, Office XP, Office 2003, you know, we clamped down on the email viruses and those sorts of things, and we felt fairly good. But essentially what happened here, and these massive spikes in XP in 2003, was a new emergent threat. Anyone familiar with the term file fuzzing? This is essentially the new threat. It's not just an issue that affects Office and Office products, but it is a fairly common attack now for a lot of different pieces of software, whether it's Flash, whether it's browsers, whether it's PDF documents or anything like that. Essentially, the approach to file fuzzing is you take a file and you just mess with it a little bit, just a little bit, and then you see what happens when the application loads that file. Does it cause a crash? Does it cause unexpected behavior? And then with that unexpected behavior, can you inject some sort of malicious action as well? And so this is a real big issue, and especially when we look at things like binary file formats, and Office opens up a lot of different file formats. There are many, many file formats, some dating back years, like 1-2-3 files and WordPerfect files and all these sorts of things that over 30 years we've built up a lot of that compatibility into Office and a lot of those features. And so the environment is quite large. And the challenge with file fuzzing is it's a really simple process to automate. You can just mess some files and then see what Office does and try and identify an attack vector, and then you can push it out wide scale. The good news is we can treat the problem with the exact same solution, and essentially we developed an automated approach to analyze and find these file format vulnerabilities and fix them. And so we call this, you can think of this if you like as a friendly botnet in our testing lab. And so, you know, when the testers aren't using our labs, we're actually using this and we're just generating all these files and logging them 24/7 over the weekend when no one's in the office doing work. Well, not everyone's in the office. We take advantage of that downtime to do even more file fuzzing. So as the team gets in on Monday morning, massive list of bugs to be fixed. And this process has had a noticeable improvement. And there's a lot of industry-recognized case studies on how we've done this. This is a link to one you can see in the slide notes. But essentially, you know, when they looked at the exploitable and probably exploitable crashes that could be caused by this approach, you can see here that over time, Office 2010 there, even with file validation disabled, has got that the amount of exploitable crashes down to zero in this particular study. Obviously, we can continue to do this this work. There are always new threats for us to look at and us to cater for. But when we start to think about Office 365 and security, the important point here is that user protection starts with authentication. This is a service. It's a user-driven service. And so the Active Directory piece is really the core thing that you need to get right, and that is still your responsibility as you move to Office 365. There are a number of different ways you can look at Active Directory. We've had a few sessions on it at this conference already. But essentially, we have this notion of Cloud ID, and that's when you're provisioning your users directly into Office 365, and it's not connected to your own Active Directory, so it's different usernames and different passwords. We have this option of Directory Sync, and what Directory Sync does is it allows you to replicate all of your users from your Active Directory into Office 365. So you're loading in them and you can keep it synchronized. Importantly there, we are not storing passwords. We don't synchronize passwords. So even though the username would be the same to sign into Office 365, the password would be different. We don't want to synchronize passwords philosophically, we don't believe in it. Because we don't want, you know, we don't need to know your domain admin password, and that domain admin probably has an email account. And so why would you even want to synchronize that information across Office 365? Is our approach. Obviously, there are third-party tools that can do that password synchronization process. You can write PowerShell scripts to automate that process and all those sorts of things as well. But philosophically, we don't believe in storing your passwords from your Active Directory in Office 365. Yes? Token solutions? Absolutely. And so the next approach that we have here is essentially using Active Directory Federation services. And so Active Directory Federation services is our recommended approach to getting single sign-on, same sign-on to work, having the same username and password to log into Office 365. And just at a high level, the way that this works is when a user tries to log into Office 365 and you have ADFS set up, we actually redirect that authentication request to your own server, and then you verify that that user is who they say they are, and then you generate a token. We essentially establish a one-way trust with your ADFS server, and so you need a certificate, obviously, to sign that server, and you can set up a one-way trust that Office 365 trusts your server to generate these credentials, or these tokens, essentially, and then we allow you into the server. So in that scenario, you're getting single sign-on, but your passwords aren't being stored in Office 365. You control that. That's a little bit of a more heavyweight solution. You do have to run Active Directory Federation services in a high availability mode, because if that server goes down, then no one can log into their email as well.
I don't have a local directory agent. Mm-hmm.
Token solutions without Active Directory Federation services? No. No, yeah. We don't support using multi-factor authentication without Active Directory Federation services. So there are your options, but again, user protection starts with authentication and authorization, making sure you're really strong in this piece. You know, you don't want this to be the weakest link in your environment. Again, having Active Directory in place really allows you to start to secure your users and secure your clients with group policy as well. Group policy settings in Office, in Link, and all the desktop applications in Internet Explorer mandate settings for Office and for all these applications. There are a number of other things that you can do to set preferences, but the beauty of group policies is they mandate solutions. They mandate these settings where they're mandatable. You can also set group policy preference for some features that aren't mandatable. And this is very different when you look at different platforms. Obviously, Mac doesn't have a group policy concept. All you can do there is set preferences, but the user can always change them later. So Windows, in this case, is a much more secure environment for establishing these Office settings. And then, of course, we have a lot of guidance on how you can set up these group policies. We publish a set of baselines. There are about 4,000 different group policy objects you can set, more than anyone should need. But you don't want to go through 4,000 settings and document 4,000 settings of what you changed. And so we actually publish a set of baselines for you to take that are pre-documented with not only the impact of setting a group policy setting, but also the impact of the risk mitigation you're doing by setting or not setting that particular feature. So, you know, that's your clients, but then when you start thinking about the service, we take a defense in-depth approach. Right from the lowest level, the facility itself, to our network, the Microsoft network that we back onto. You may or may not know, but we have actually one of the third largest fiber optic networks in the world, connecting at Microsoft data centers with peering arrangements to local carriers and essentially a content delivery network that allows us to deliver all of our services, whether that's you downloading software from TechNet or the Volume Licensing Center, or whether it's you playing games on Xbox Live, or whether it's you doing Bing searches or using Office 365. We all leverage that massive fiber optic network to deliver this at speed and secure system as well. But at the facility itself, we have a number of physical controls, video surveillance, access control to the facility itself. On the network perimeter, things like edge routers, intrusion detection systems, constant proactive and reactive vulnerability scanning. On the internal network itself, for anyone to get access to that network, it's dual-factor authentication. It's not the case that Office 365, anyone with a Microsoft domain account, can't log into a server. These are a very segregated network that we're using here to run this system itself. We need multiple smart cards for our users to service these servers remotely. On the host level, the host operating system, again, more active control and monitoring, anti-malware, patch, configuration management running here. The applications, the secure engineering processes, the SDL we talked about before. Access control, again, monitoring, anti-malware, account management, obviously training, awareness, screening of employees that have access to this data. Access control, again, at the data level, the storage level. And then threat and vulnerability management that incorporates all of these things. You can imagine this generates quite a lot of logs. We generate terabytes and terabytes of logs every day for this system. And so a lot of our systems are designed to actually profile that and also not only find or try and detect any breaches, but also detect patterns that we think that something may be happening that we don't quite expect, or there is some unexpected scenario happening, and you can see some things over time may change, certain servers failing over to other servers, all those sorts of things that we can notice here and that we model and that we can constantly look at for proactive protection. So, in a sample facility, and I'd encourage you to come down to our booth and you can see some of the, we have our little model of what a Microsoft data center looks like. But it is a 24/7 guarded facility. There's a human in loop at these facilities. They monitor the environmentals of the facility itself. We actually monitor the service remotely as well across all of our data centers. These shots here are an example of the Chicago data center. This is one of the few ones that we do talk about publicly. It's won some awards for data center design. It's about 700,000 square feet. I believe when it reaches capacity, it'll be something like 80,000 servers, and we keep about 5 days of backup power on hand just in case that our regular supply of power goes on. So these are massive, massive facilities that are powering the Office 365 and many of the other Microsoft cloud solutions. Anyone else have a 700,000 square foot data center? No? Okay. Yeah. So, for a small business, you just can't match this sort of security and this sort of attention to detail that we can do. We talk a lot about the economies of scale that you get with Office 365, and I guess everyone can see the benefit of the economies of scale we get. But one of the other things that you also get is an economy of skill. It's the Exchange team running Exchange Online. It's the SharePoint team running SharePoint Online. Who better to run these solutions? Who better to fix these solutions? Who better to patch these solutions than the team that built it themselves? And so there's, for a small business, you may not even have that expertise and that amount of security researchers to monitor your service and monitor your topologies and your implementations to make sure that they're as secure as possible. Question? Yes?
Can I still maintain my own backups?
Can you still maintain your own backups? Yeah, absolutely. And so, in the case of Exchange, it's your data. I think the legal term is data processor. We're a data processor. It's not our data. We don't claim any ownership of that data. You can do what you want with it. In the case of Exchange, you can journal out to an external system. In the case of SharePoint, you can take site collection backups. Again, Active Directory and all those other configurations that you set. We work on making all of that as easy to export as possible, not only for backups and those sorts of things, but also so that we can enable hybrid solutions, so you can have some users on premises, some users online, and move them back and forth if you need to as well. A question up the back, yeah.
Do you offer Microsoft or Office 365 offer backup and archiving solutions for exchange?
Absolutely. So We do. So in the case of Exchange, we have the default 25 gig mailbox. You can actually allocate 5 gig of that to the primary mailbox and leave the next 20 gig for archiving. We also have a plan a plan that you can purchase. So, with unlimited archiving, essentially unlimited archiving, I shouldn't say unlimited, for 10 years to keep essentially an archive of that. So you can have a 25 gig primary mailbox and then archive everything for 10 years as well. And it's just using native Exchange functionality, the in-place archiving capabilities that we can run at massive scale and keep that in the inbox itself so that users can still see that information. Question? Good question. So the question was, how would migrating to the next system work? We do it. Our intention is that no IT action required on your side. Obviously, you can enable new capabilities as they come out. But the patching, the release cycle for Office 365 is actually much faster. We don't, with on-premises software, it does take us a few years to build, to test, and then to test every different possible implementation that customers might have, every topology that you may imagine. And so that a lot of work is in testing to make sure that it can work on any weird and wonderful scenario that you guys might build yourself. So we do a lot of work to make that to happen. For Office 365, we have essentially one topology. There's a couple of different ones, but much less variables in how this system is set up. So we deploy features a lot faster. We actually have a monthly release cadence now on Exchange and SharePoint and Link and all the services. So we deploy features when they're ready. We can test them, and then we can roll them out. And essentially, the way that works is that we can deploy those features in the background without interrupting your business, your email. We do have some planned maintenance windows that we publish in advance for anything that may require us to take servers offline. And so in a couple of the cases, when we upgraded some areas of Exchange, if your particular Outlook client was talking to that particular server at that time, you may notice 5 minutes of mail not sending before it clicks over and points at a different mail server and those sorts of things. And so then when we think about moving to the next version of Exchange and the next version of SharePoint, because it is just on-prem software running in an online service, we'll actually do the same approach in that way as well. We'll upgrade it in the background for you. We patch it in the background for you. And we'll also manage that major upgrade between major systems as well. We jokingly refer to Office 365 as the last migration you'll ever have to do, because then it's our work. And so in the products themselves, in the workloads themselves, there are a lot of security features just native in the business productivity, from things like multi-layered protection from spam and malware, financially backed service level agreements, in-product controls that you can help prevent your users from external threats or help protect your users from themselves, which is also a common area. But this is just built into the product. So those controls you have with Exchange, you still have access to in the Office 365 Exchange Online environment as well. In terms of information security, you can set policy rules, transport rules, inspect emails in transit to be able to flag them and do those sorts of things, just like you can do with Exchange 2010 today. You can integrate Active Directory rights management services if you want to safeguard sensitive data and encrypt that data, if that's a requirement that you have. You can use TLS to do end-to-end encryption between trusted partners and those sorts of things as well. And again, visibility and control you get out of these systems, the integrated administration scenario, reporting built into the products, auditing built into the services as well. You can have role-based access control here, so you can set some administrators to only have some access or access to specific scenarios. There should be no reason that your SharePoint administrator has access to Exchange unless he's the Exchange administrator as well. You can set that. You can even set things like allow help desk to reset user passwords, but don't allow them to configure transport rules or something like that. So you can get very, very granular with how your own IT team manages these services as well. I mean, yeah.
I need to have a local director to use LMS, or can you just have the user on 365
Active Directory, you'd build that on premises and to rights management, yes. And then, of course, mobile security as well. So you can, just using the base ActiveSync controls built into Exchange, you can manage mobile security policies. You can remote wipe devices. You can quarantine devices. You can set different policies. Perhaps if you don't allow devices, you may not allow Android devices, let's say, into your environment. You can actually block whole categories of devices, if you like, or particular units that you know to be not safe or jailbroken or something like that. From getting access to ActiveSync email. Okay, so a common security concern. Data at rest is not encrypted in Office 365. This is a question that comes up a lot. People ask, is the data encrypted at rest? No, it's not. We do that for a number of reasons. Firstly, it impacts the functionality of the system. For instance, search, indexing, reporting. There are identity and key management issues. What's the point of Microsoft encrypting the data? What's the point of having encrypted data if I don't trust Microsoft to begin with? You guys have the keys, so you can unencrypt it if you really needed to as well. So what we recommend is that you use solutions like rights management services or SMIME to encrypt the documents that you absolutely require to be encrypted at rest. In this way, you're making the decision of what's important to you. You're keeping the keys. We don't have the keys to your rights management system, so we can't look at that data if that's what you're worried about in this scenario as well. So we think we have a pretty good solution here. We have very strong security processes in place, but data encryption at rest is not in the multi-tenanted Office 365 service.
And just to add, we don't store all your data in a contiguous location. So the data is sort of striped and spread out within different data centers. So even if someone runs away with a particular hard drive or a server, it's not as if they can reverse engineer your data.
Yeah. In the case of hard drives, they never leave the data center. We either do a military-grade wipe of that data, rewriting with random ones and zeros, I think it's 7 times or something like that, if we can still use the hard drive. If the hard drive is inoperable, we shred them on site. We turn nice square hard drives into fine powdery dust on site, so the data never leaves the data center.
Question.
Yep. There is. It's slightly different. So it is a user-based model. I believe it is 10 gig per tenant and then 500 meg per user in a resource pool. You can also purchase extra storage. I think the rate is 20 cents a gigabyte for any extra specs on that. But that's our model for SharePoint storage. Exchange, over the years, it's done a lot of work to make sure that it can run on really, really cheap storage, on JBOD storage rather than really expensive disks. SharePoint, on the other hand, still has a SQL backend, so it is a little bit more costly to run SharePoint storage than it is Exchange storage at this point in time. And it's the exact same on premises as well, I'm sure you'll find. We've told you a lot of stuff about security. How do you know you can trust us? I guess I'll pass back to Bharath to talk about this piece as well.
So we have a lot of independent auditors and third-party accounting firms audit us and essentially give certifications for a variety of standards. We often get asked the question, can I come and audit your services? And these questions are asked by a variety of customers. It's just simply not scalable to have all our customers come and audit us. Then we'd spend all our time answering to audit questions. So one of the better ways to make things easy for both the customer and Microsoft is to rely on third-party auditors who will come and audit Microsoft and certify Microsoft to a commonly agreed upon set of standards. And those are the set of standards that they would use to essentially evaluate any IT service provider in the market. So this is an easy way for customers to compare and contrast as to how Microsoft performs against some of the other cloud services company in the market.
And it is a really important distinction. And the other issue here is that how do you even know how to audit 100,000 of server environment? Right? It is a very, you know, and how do you know which data is yours? And you wouldn't want your competitors auditing your data, and you wouldn't, and so we wouldn't want anyone access to that information. So we do use specialist auditing firms to be able to do this work that actually understand how to audit this particular approach. A question?
Yeah.
In this case, you know, we generally work with you to work out what your auditing requirements are. And it is still your data at the end of the day. We can give you that data. But letting you into the data center to count servers or to verify what's going on is not something that we allow. And so we generally take the ISO 27001 standard, which is a world-class widely recognized standard, and we publish all of those controls that we have there to meet so that you can be comfortable enough to match up the controls we have in ISO 27001 with the actual controls that you need to meet for your own regulatory standard. And they're very different standards with very different models. I guess at the end of the day, you guys need to decide what standards are important to you and whether the Office 365 service can meet them. We think we've established a great baseline of controls, and we're using that baseline of controls that's audited with ISO 27001 to then actually meet other widely used standards as well. So case of FISMA, FISMA compliance, HIPAA compliance, EU model clauses. I think we'll have a slide coming up, but we can talk about all the different services we comply with. But then there's another branch of certifications as well, which is really certifying or accrediting your particular implementation. In those sorts of environments, it's really the customer that you need to audit your own environment and take what we say and what we've got audited as a baseline. And then it's your particular implementation on top of that, how you've configured Exchange Online, what transport rules you have, you know, what permissions you have in place. And that's essentially when you look at the some of the other ISO standards are like that you have documented policies in place. It's not just a technology audit, it's a process audit. And that actually requires your IT department to do some of the work as well. Some of that you'll essentially outsource to Microsoft, and we'll publish our controls through ISO 27001 as well to kind of continue the Visio diagram, if you like, of how those processes might work.
We also have a very scalable set of processes on how to build upon existing compliance standards that we have. We essentially start with a business policy that tries to meet a specific compliance standard, and then we have a set of control framework that aligns around that business policy to check if the business policy is being followed or not. And then that essentially maps to a set of standards that combination of policy and control framework maps to. And there is a detailed list of operating procedures, a step-by-step list of procedures that our operations personnel and our data center strategy essentially follows to meet a particular set of standards or to meet a particular standard. So if you're going for a whole new certification process, then what will happen is, and this happened in the case of ISO 27001 and FISMA, there's a large intersection between these two standards. So this helps us be scalable and not reinvent the wheel every single time we pursue a new standard, but we essentially can easily identify existing standards that we already follow and then build on the delta that the new certification process imposes on us. So the purpose of showing this to you is to show that we have a very well thought out and a scalable process to gain more standards that you may want Microsoft to pursue. So here's a look at some of the standards and some of the regulations that we do meet. And I, just an overarching comment, we now follow close to 10 or 11 big standards or regulatory policies that the different countries have in place. And this set of standards, we are pretty much the only cloud service provider in the industry to follow all of these standards at the same time. And regardless of whether you sign a contract that pertaining to the standards or not, the processes that will happen in the data center will apply to your data. It's just that if you don't sign, you may not get notified in certain instances. If you do sign, you will get notifications on certain changes. But the processes and the security will always apply to your data. So ISO 27001 is the standard in which our service is based out of. This is an internationally recognized standard, and it specifically talks about security. So it's one of the best security benchmarks in the world, and we essentially pursued this as our first certification option, and we were the first business productivity cloud service provider to get this standard. EU model clauses is a very interesting case. This is a set of contract terms and conditions that we sign with all customers, regardless of their size. And the way this works is the European Union regulatory body has a defined pre-existing set of contract terms and conditions that we can just cut and paste into our contract without any modifications. So we are not allowed to amend those terms. It's just you just have to drag and drop those set of clauses to make sure that we meet that rigor of standards. So think about this as regulator-endorsed clauses. And the key thing is that our processes with which we handle data are so consistent and scalable that we don't have to do this on a one-off basis or on a case-by-case basis. We just have opened the doors for any customer to come and sign these clauses and be subject to it.
So even though we are running these services, some of the accreditations and the compliance standards like this do require you to opt in to say, yes, I want a service with these policies, but we're running them in the background anyway. The EU model clauses are particularly privacy-related, I believe, as well.
So the next agreement that we offer, which is the data processing agreement, this again addresses the privacy, security, and how Microsoft handles your data. So think of this as an aggregation of unique security and privacy policies that are there in different countries. So what we do is we aggregate them into a single contract bucket, and we sign it across all customers. So think of this as the best security and privacy practices across the world being brought to every single customer who opts in for Office 365. So the HIPAA high-tech is mainly for healthcare customers. What we do is we sign the business associate agreement with healthcare customers, and signing this agreement helps the customer become HIPAA compliant. One of the common misconceptions is that Microsoft Office 365 is HIPAA compliant. We are not a healthcare company. We can never be HIPAA compliant. What an IT cloud service provider can do is make the customer become HIPAA compliant. And the key thing or a necessary step that's required to make the customer HIPAA compliant would be to have the BAA signed by the cloud service provider. This is a key step because there are certain contractual commitments and processes in there as to how quickly and how soon will Microsoft notify you in cases of security breach, how we handle your data, how we address personally identifiable health information and all those things. So signing this contract is very important for the customer to meet HIPAA high-tech compliance.
And many of these compliance regulations or certification models are not only to do with how you store the data and how secure you keep it, but also how you handle an unexpected event, how you recover from that, what controls, what processes, what crisis management do you do as well. And so all of this is documented in these services. And we share this information with our customers as well. We generally don't do it publicly because it's fairly sensitive information, But as customer or prospective customers, you know, under non-disclosure agreements and those sorts of things, we can actually share you all of our best practices and our documented processes for a lot of these different standards.
So EU Safe Harbor is another standard template EU regulatory set of terms and conditions that governs data transfer in and out of the European Union. This essentially also applies to businesses within the US that in turn do business with companies that are located within the European Union. So if Microsoft Office 365 follows the EU safe harbor principles, then the customer using the service can feel safe about doing business with European customers. So like I mentioned before, all the listed compliance and regulatory standards are now offered by Office 365. This is a very comprehensive set of offers. What you don't see here is FERPA, which pertains to the education sector. We also offer that. There is also PIPDA, which is the Canadian privacy law. We also offer that. But outside of that, we offer ISO 27001, EU model clauses, FISMA, the data processing agreement, and HIPAA. So like I mentioned before, regardless of whether you come and check the box to sign the contract or not, the processes, what's running in the background, applies consistently to every customer. So in effect, without like trumpeting too much, if our services are secure enough for the CIA or the Department of Defense, it's very secure for a commercial business. So, and we apply the same processes that we apply to the CIA or the Department of Defense to any business customer of ours.
So SSA E16, if you're not familiar with that, is the new name for the SAS 70 certification, which you may have heard of as well.
That's correct. We now have Type 1. We've listed Type 1. We are also pursuing SOC 2 and SOC 3 in the future.
Our data centers themselves also have a separate set of credentials. Obviously, for Office 365 to be compliant with some of these credentials, our data centers do. We also have a longer list of certifications that our data centers themselves meet for the hardware and the physical security.
It's planned for in the future.
The service is.
Does require encryption at rest?
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how you can. So we have a big data center. We have all similar controls that mm-hmm. you guys do, but our sensitive data has to be encrypted at rest.
Yeah.
I've seen some of these same standards being applied to. So mm-hmm. how can you abide by the standards if you can't?
So. You can encrypt data at rest using rights management service and put in encrypted data into the system. We just don't blanket encrypt the data. Office 365 is PCI compliant itself in the fact that we store credit card information for our customers. That is encrypted at rest, but it's not kind of customer piece of Office 365. It's really the encryption is in the hands of the businesses that use the customer, yeah.
Yeah, that helps.
So this is a quick look at HIPAA, and we covered this before, so we'll quickly jump to a very quick demo. So this is on how a customer can essentially sign up for the EU Model Clauses contract or the HIPAA contract. So to start with, customers would need to visit the Trust Center. The Trust Center essentially has four sections, and one of those sections is the independently verified section. Over there, we list all the important certifications and contract regulatory contracts that we support, and we also offer a hyperlink, and EU model clauses is the example used here, but we also do it for HIPAA and so on. So we offer a hyperlink from where you can click on it and get to the contracts page. That will require you to be an IT administrator for the account. Once you sign in, you will have options on what contracts you're allowed to sign, and you can choose from those options and hit accept. And once you hit accept, you will receive acknowledgement that your signature has been recorded. So once that's complete, you are in our systems as being a HIPAA customer or being an EU model clauses customer.
So thank you very much for listening. This is a pretty important topic if you're considering Office 365. We want to make sure that you feel as safe and in good hands with Office 365 through all these approaches to security, privacy, and trust. We have a lot of Office 365 sessions here at TechEd, so if you haven't had a chance to see these sessions, they'll also be recorded. You'll be able to see them online later on as well. Trust.office365.com is the Office 365 Trust Center. It has white papers, service descriptions. We also have standard responses for RFIs, requests for information. We get these quite a lot, and often they list out a number of different security benchmarks for us to meet. And so we've done the hard work for you, and we've actually got some standard responses, some snappy answers to common questions around Office 365. And of course, the Information Security Management Framework documentation is up there as well. And with that said, thank you very much for listening. Happy to answer any questions now in the last 8 minutes of the sessions as well. Do your evals.
Is this session recorded?
This session is recorded, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
RIM being that they're heavily integrated basically into the product?
Sure. So the question was, can we speak to the physical and logical security around the BlackBerry integration for Office 365? In the case of Office 365, and this is different from BPOS, the artist formerly known as BPOS, in the past we ran our own BlackBerry BES servers in our data center. And for Office 365, we've actually moved away from that, and we're actually using BlackBerry Cloud Services and integrating with Research in Motion's own data center where they host BlackBerry Cloud Services. And so that's actually within their data center itself and has a separate set of security and compliance guidelines on the BlackBerry website. That's BlackBerry Cloud Services. Essentially, then it's a TLS connection between those services to be able to do that, and you can configure that. It's in the BlackBerry data center, but it is a free offering for PIM, email, and calendaring for BlackBerry devices. Thanks. Yeah. Yes? Yeah, so the question was, we mentioned that we spread data amongst data centers. Can we keep it within a particular government legal area? Yes, so we notify you of we spread the data across data centers, but only within that same region. So we don't spread data centers outside of that region, so you know exactly which region your data is being stored at. We may not disclose the particular data center that you're in, but you can be safe in the knowledge that it's in that area as well. This is something that comes up a lot in the United States. Our data centers are in the United States, so it's not such an issue. But outside, there are issues around data sovereignty, and there are different regulations and compliance reasons that can you store that data? If for instance, I'm in Switzerland and my data center is in Amsterdam, but we try and keep those in the same agreement. There are about 30 different variables essentially when we establish a data center. One of them is around legal framework. We want to make sure that we put the data center in a place that is safe to do business and it supports the controls that we need to support as well in this service. Yes, question up the back. What is the can you will we support good technology for PIM management? Good question. We don't have good technology in the data center. We don't use that. You can use good apps for iOS and iPhone against Office 365, I believe, you know, to sandbox the actual devices itself. But we don't support that from our data center itself. I'm not too familiar with GUID, I'm sorry, so can't give you much more information on that. The Windows Phone team that are downstairs, you know, we have a GUID app for Windows Phone, so those guys would be good to reach out to as well. Great, well, thank you very much for your time. We're almost out of time, but we'll hang around up the front in case you have any other questions that you don't want recorded. Thanks again.
Thank you.